Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Thalery Report. I'm joined by Tim Kavan, and we're here to talk about the equity overview for the annual wrap-up, all of 2023. We're going to look back at 2023, then discuss some key issues, and there are a lot of key issues. It's a very unique market, and then look forward into 2024, very much with a mind to your questions about what you should do in terms of your managing your assets. So anyway, Tim, it's a pleasure always to welcome you back. And I would say that last year was not what we expected it would be.
No, it was, you know, surprisingly good. And it makes me think of all the different prognostications about collapse for 2024, and that we just need to be humble and mindful that not all the predictions are always right.
Well, last year, one of the stories I picked out on the annual wrap-up was Bloomberg, right at the end of the year, 70% of the economists said, you know, recession and indicate, you know, clearly a very down equity market. And that's not what happened. Now,
Yeah. If
you look at what happened, I almost would have preferred a big down to, because the plunder economy won.
It did. All the control people did very well, and everybody else lagged at best.
Right. Okay, so let's take a look at the market performance. So how did equity, let's talk about equities and debt, because, you know, clearly Powell took interest rates up, and if you look at it, slaughtered commodities and it slaughtered bonds, and then he softened before the end of the year. So we came down a little bit, but tell us a little bit about how equities did versus bonds.
Yeah, I mean, equities were positive, and I think that bonds were also positive, but they're coming back from a huge negative year when the Fed originally raised rates and had big negatives on the bond indexes. So, bonds were up to some degree, but not, and stocks were up, and then the magnificent, so-called Magnificent Seven knocked it out of the park, and the other equity markets were kind of in line. I think, the tech stocks relative to the U.S. stock market outperformed, and the U.S. performed better than developed European markets, Europe, and that kind of thing, and they also performed better than emerging markets. So,
right. Although I just took it was very interesting because I call it the plunder economy. You had the control stock, so big tech, but then you had KKR and the equity player. It's not a lot of them, but basically the message all year long was crime pays. That's what I saw. And so the stock market was up, but it was very depressing.
Yeah. The people that are doing things that we may not, may not be the highest ethical way to operate seemed to do well.
So if you look, I don't know if you had a chance to read the Rambus report, but I always love Rambus because he doesn't buy into the collapse narrative. Mm-hmm. He just looks at what's really happening and tries to be completely open-minded and not get vested in a narrative anyway. But he calls it PBC, the post-bubble contraction. That everybody keeps predicting and waiting for. And so now he refers to it as PVC. But one of the things you look at when you look at his charts is I did not realize how badly the whole commodity sector had gotten clocked by the interest rates. I mean, taking the interest rates up really did help taper inflation in the commodity sector.
I think I always, just from a trading perspective, remember that commodities trade in dollars. So right. If interest rates go up and that tends to strengthen the dollar, then that puts a cap on commodities.
Right. And a couple things that surprised me as I looked at his charts, one is how strong industrials is right now. Industrials and how strongly real estate came back. And home construction came back from the softening of interest rates. Just boom, shot up. And China clearly had a very bad year.
So.
So the other thing that, so I described it as a bifurcating market because you see this bifurcation between the plunder guys and everybody else. But then you see this huge bifurcation between the United States and China. with China, you know, with the S&P up much stronger than everybody expected, and China down for the year. The large caps really down.
Yeah. It makes me think of like the book that I think you did an interview with, Unbalanced, by Stephen Roach, which is the describe the relationship between China and the U.S. as codependent. And anybody who's ever known somebody in a codependent relationship realizes it can get ugly. And, you know, somebody wins and somebody loses, I guess. But
Well, China's choking on its debt, and China's choking on a real estate bubble. I mean, you know, so anybody in the U.S., as certainly me, cannot criticize another country for bad real estate bubbles, because we have the mother of all real estate bubbles. But they have a serious real estate bubble problem and a serious local debt problem. So it will be, you know, and their growth is clearly slowed. So anyway, and it's funny because now the, you know, EEM, the emerging markets ETF, is, I think, as much as 50% China. So yeah. It's very hard to separate. I don't know, when I look at emerging markets, I look at the individual stocks.
I mean, to me, one thing that comes to mind is then to the degree that China has trouble, does that impact at all their ability to buy treasuries or hold treasuries?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Negative feedback loop that's possible.
Right. Oh, that we're in that negative feedback loop. You know, we're definitely in that negative feedback.
Yeah.
And if you look at what they've been doing, I cover this in State of Our Currency. If you look at what they're doing to build out the liquidity of their currency globally, it's very, very significant. And I think a lot of what we're watching in the Middle East relates to the struggle over the U.S. trying to maintain that market share. Okay. Another thing I wanted to bring up was the 60-40 portfolio, because for my whole lifetime, everybody's been told the way to get safe is as they get closer to retirement, they just keep taking up the fixed income proportion and that will protect them. And now that's out the window.
Yes. And that's it matters, especially with the bond, like traditional bond funds that are part of a 60-40 portfolio, like the Vanguard Total Bond Fund. And it's interesting to think about if something drops by 50% in 1 year, in order to get back to flat, it now has to go up 100%.
Right.
And so while those funds have, while the bond indices have kind of maybe leveled off or come back a little bit, they're coming back from a big down when the Fed originally raised rates, and that caused bond prices to go down. Right. So it's, and I don't think it, because of the interest rate, because of the potential for interest rates to go up and down relative to different world events or Fed policy, all these different things, it's not a no-brainer to just set it and forget it in bonds anymore. And, you know, I think you have to be a little more attentive to bonds. And I try to suggest to people to set a goal to try to not lose money in bonds. And if you set that goal, then you have to think about what causes bonds to lose money and not, and then how can I approach that? And
right.
the simple ways to do that are things like, you know, in more recent times, last couple of years, you can hold very short term instruments or even money markets and earn a good rate on that,
right,
and not be subject to losing money. Or the other way to do it is whatever kind of bond you hold, hold an individual bond and be able to hold it to maturity. And as long as you hold it to maturity and it's a good credit, so you don't lose money, they don't go bankrupt, then you won't lose money. So that's how I think about it.
So right now, I love dividends and I love coupons. So to me, buying really, we'll get into this later, getting really good credit bonds with a good coupon, which you could do in the last year for the first mm-hmm. time in a long time,
yeah,
suddenly started to look a little bit more attractive than stocks. At the same time, to me, you've got to know exactly what bond you're buying, because I think the credit problems in the fixed income market are just unacceptable.
Yes. Yeah. And you have to look at your individual situation and
right.
consider things like munis, or you have to know what you hold. I agree.
Exactly. Okay. So one of the things we saw, so I believe, to me, I had always been trained, if you get a rise of more than 150 basis points in interest rate within a year, it can really clock the the stock market. And yet, you know, we saw that kind of rise and the stock market has done remarkably well.
Yeah, it really makes you wonder. I think as recently as 2018, that phenomenon, when interest rates go up by more than 150%, at the time, the Fed started raising interest rates in 2018. They said, we're raising. And then the stock market rolled over. And then they switched to we're cutting. And that was right prior to COVID. So that phenomenon still existed then. And now right we're observing this where, and you know, one suggestion I've heard from different economists is that the amount of stimulus that has been put into the market from the, you know, the different government policies has kind of like potentially maybe pre-funded the decline on a broad basis because right there's been so much stimulus that came in during COVID and stuff. But how easy is that to prove? I don't know, but it's just another factor to think about, I think.
I am absolutely certain it's true.
Yeah.
Because if you're tracking the budget and the sort of the difference. So, for example, the money they're putting in after COVID now, the money they're injecting in biodefense, you know, you're talking about enormous amounts of financial methadone. It's the only way I can describe it. And I think it's one of the reasons.
That's a good way to describe it.
It's one of the reasons the plunder economy is doing so well, because they're basically in the syndicate anticipating where the money's going to go and going there. And then the money comes in. Yeah. And it's, you know, but it's a game that weakens the economy. And I hate to say it, it's a game that our pension funds are financing. So when CalSTR announced that it was going to borrow to make its benefit payments, I went and looked at the CalSTR portfolio and they were down to like 15% in fixed income. And they had a higher percentage in private equity than in fixed income, which is astonishing, you know?
Yeah.
And you know, but if you look at their returns on private equity, there's no way they're making that returns without the plunder economy.
Yes. Yeah.
That's my take.
Yeah. And that's a kind of a concerning thing when the pension funds announce that they're borrowing.
Well, I couldn't figure out why. You know, why, if you look at it, most of their money comes in from the schools. The state only gives about $4 billion a year in contributions to CalSTRS. So CalSTRS, for those who don't know, is the Teachers Pension Fund of California. So I think it's the second largest in the country, one of the largest in the country.
Yeah.
CalPERS being the largest. So the state only puts in $4 billion a year, but the state has a $68 billion deficit. And one of the possibilities is the state trying to get them to borrow essentially their contribution so they can, you know, delay it for some reason.
It's possible. I guess then the question I ask myself is like, well, why doesn't the state just keep building the Tower of Babel, so to speak, with issuing credit, issuing bonds? Like what would stop them from just borrowing to?
Because CalSTRS has a better credit, so it's cheaper for CalSTRS to finance
but
it than.
Then that, if that's true, then that tells you the rubber is really meeting the road here where.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's getting more towards each man for himself, so to speak.
Well, I think we're there.
Yes. But I mean, even when the big guy, so it's long been each man for himself for the little people. But
right.
But when the big guys start having, it's kind of makes me think of your suggestion about the Minionites. About,
right.
You know, where, I don't have anything to give and neither do you. So you better make the best decision you can because I'm not helping you anymore.
The Minionite thing is on, and one of the great I'm about to record Money in Markets tomorrow with John Titus.
Yeah,
my favorite story for the week is Hertz cancels and it's selling 20,000 electric cars, which says, you know something, I don't care about the agenda. You know, it doesn't work economically, so we're not doing it. Okay,
yeah.
And that's a signal to everybody else. You know, when the Japanese professors stand up and say the injection's killing people, you know, that's not going to spread as quickly virally because, the next professor doesn't want to get fired.
Yeah.
But when Hertz sells 20,000 electric cars and gets rid of them, you know, it's a signal to every business. You have no choice. You might as well do it, you know.
You have and to then, do what makes sense economically if you're a business. You
right.
can't just toe the line and continue to lose money. I mean, that was a third of their fleet of electric vehicles, I think. I think they
really?
Had a total of, I believe the article I read said they had like 60,000. They sold 20,000 of them. So,
wow.
And I think the other thing it said was that the maintenance on those is higher than a gas-powered vehicle.
Right.
So, which is interesting.
Well, it reminds me of the old saying, he who panics first panics best.
Yeah.
Anyway, but because there is so much, the market seems to be so dependent on the methadone and the fiscal outlook is deteriorating, there is a real question, how long can they keep this game going?
Yeah. And it,
no one knows.
You don't know. And, you know, I mean, how much, at what point does the Fed's interest rate policy lose potency? Because the debt, I mean, when you see the debt, the interest on the debt where it's more than the defense budget.
Right.
And then you realize that if interest rates go up anymore, that's going to get worse. That's the problem's going to get worse.
Right.
And are there tools left from the Fed standpoint, if they're the 800-pound gorilla and they're looked at to handle things? Do the tools they have, are they still potent? And I guess at the end of the day, it's really money printing. It's not necessarily the interest rate policy that they can use as a fail safe, so to speak. But at some point, it'll come home to roost, I think. Who knows when that's going to be?
So I want to describe a series of situations. When you talk to world leaders, so I have several colleagues who've been off talking to world leaders about backing out of the WHO amendments and the WHO treaty. And what they say is we're in a debt trap, and if we don't go along, they'll pull our loans. Okay?
Yeah.
They're very clear. We're in a debt trap. If you talk to state treasurers, why can't you put your money in the banks in state? Why do you have to put it up in New York where you're hostage? They say they offer us a higher interest rate, and as fiduciaries, we have to go with them. And then if you say to the state legislatures, you know, the federal education money requires you to teach your children to be sex slaves. Why don't you cancel it? What they'll tell you is we're financially dependent on the money. Now, what's interesting is if you listen to all those people, they're describing a financial dependency on money that is being printed by the central banks, who are doing it in a way that is attributed as debt to you. So you're basically borrowing from your own future because the liability is going to be stuck to you.
Mm.
And you're being made dependent on bankrupting yourself is the only way I can describe it. And yet nobody's figured out politically how to say, no, it's more important to be sovereign than to get this extra 20%.
Yeah. And I think that to me, the answer of, we're fiduciaries, so we have to earn the highest rate. That's kind of a cop-out because you know, there's something called the prudent investor rule that's used right. as a guideline for investment managers. But I would say that if they stated they want to invest in a certain investment that doesn't necessarily earn the highest rate, they could find lawyers that would argue why that meets the prudent
right.
investor rule.
They just
don't want to do it because it's harder. Maybe it's more expensive to do that. And they don't want to be the first person to raise their head above the parapet, so to speak.
Right. Anyway, so one of the things I would say is the scenario I call planet equity is on, which is, you know, after the financial crisis, everybody said it's going to collapse. I said, no, what's going to happen is the equity market's going to go up because they're not going to write down the debt. They're going to mark up the equity. And that's what they're doing.
And even in the stock market, in the S&P 500, the fact that went straight up essentially during COVID. So during COVID, it went down 35%. And then people said, oh, that's the exact level of a bear market and met some people got out. And then it went straight up. And if you overlay the graph of that going straight up with the headlines, the death, the destruction, the vaccination, all of it, they weren't aligned.
Right. So we saw a couple of interesting developments that I want to bring up in 2023. One was the Koreans banned naked short selling. Now, that sounds like not an important story to somebody in the Western world. But if you look at all the shenanigans and naked short selling that are going on, for countries to start banning it is a real slap in the face to the U.S. institutions. Well deserved. Well deserved.
Yeah. To me, that's a promise that it matters how much you enforce it. And how do you enforce it? So some of that comes down to the technical details. It can be done, but you would really have to not just issue the statement, but then follow it up.
Right, you're gonna have to find firms and in fact throw some of them out.
Yeah.
So, but another thing that happened is we saw a book called The Great Taking by a friend of mine, David Webb, sort of move virally, and really. It's had a couple of impacts. I don't know if you realize this in the annual wrap-up. Instead of doing the Bizarro World section, we did a taking section. And we listed all the takings I could think of since World War II or the 1900s on. And it was shocking to me because I've never done that before. I never sat down and made a list of all the takings. And you do it and you think, it's amazing we're standing. It's amazing we're as wealthy as we are. Because they just keep harvesting and harvesting. And the number of takings are amazing. One of the things that I found very disconcerting about the response to David's book was, I was like, wait a minute, we're in the middle of many great takings. How come you're not upset about, the ones that are going on currently?
Yeah.
It's always anticipated. I made a list of four great takings coming up. But anyway, so I was kind of shocked that they would be more concerned with a taking of the securities portfolios than the ones that are, have been going on. But the other thing I learned was there's an extraordinary number of wealthy people who thought because they had a big stock portfolio that they were protected.
Yeah, and so far they have been, right? If they have,
right.
But
right.
They, and that kind of, I think, is the, their, I don't, for lack of a better word, maybe the security blanket, the thing you always look back on and say, okay, this is all bad, but I have a big investment portfolio, so I'm okay. And so I guess that triggers all of a sudden, like, whoa, that's what I've always been thinking about to myself as the reason why I'm going to be okay. And now somebody's questioning that. And so you're right. Like, people haven't looked at what about all these other ones, but they never paid attention.
Well, but there's a failure to integrate. If you look at why your portfolio has been doing well, so let's say I have a couple million dollars in a equity portfolio and a little bit of bonds, and it's been doing well since 2013. Okay, so I've been going up, and that makes me feel secure. It's been going up because all the governmental entities that I pay taxes to and are supposed to be responsible to me are essentially borrowing huge amounts of money, which are going to be attributed to me, and using it to pump into the market something that's building a control model that's going to steal my assets and wipe me out. So I'm financing my own liquidation.
But to break through with someone and to have them realize that is not easy. It's like being in a trance where you can't, even if somebody watches this discussion and says, there's some people that won't, it's like denial. It won't click. And they just keep going down the road.
So I know a tremendous number of people who it's clicked with. And then the challenge, and it's not an easy challenge, is, okay, how do you get out of that? How do you find a path?
Another challenge.
Right. Yeah. That's a bigger challenge. And so, but clearly the economic model we're living in doesn't make sense. And so the question is, okay, well, what do you do about it? But I was shocked to learn that so many people believed that they were not on the menu. And now my theory is the last thing Mr. Global is going to do is do a taking of the securities, because the securities are a weapon and they're working. I said to somebody, why would a housewife give away her weapon in the middle of, why would a housewife give away a vacuum cleaner in the middle of vacuuming the house? She's only half done. Right.
Yeah. But that same thought process, so I agree with that. And but then it's part of what keeps the equity market performing.
Right. Right. So I do think we're coming into some serious great takings, but the, you know, securities is not the one I'm worried about.
I think the one thing, though, given what you said, the end of that book, I believe he says something to the effect of, you know, the rich think they're special and they're saving you for dessert.
Right.
And so at least that recognition that, hey, maybe I need to start paying attention.
That, you know, something that it is a great service.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think the research that David and his colleagues have done is also a great service. I really do. And it shows you, you know, because it took me years to face the extent of the collateral fraud in the mortgage market. And then I started to see the collateral fraud more widely in the fixed income market. And then David and his colleagues have really dug in and found the collateral fraud in the securities market, in the equity market. And, you know, it's that bad. And that's one of the reasons when insiders look at changing this, they're like, you know, How do you transform the house of cards? It's hard.
Yes. Yeah. Right. When you're living in it, when you're living in the house of cards and you have to transform it. Yeah.
Right. Right. A couple things I wanted to bring up. One is we're about to do a recording, Carolyn Betts and I, on natural asset companies. And you have a brouhaha because different treasurers, we now have 23 treasurers led by the treasurer of Utah, trying to get the SEC to postpone its approval of a new rule that will allow natural asset companies. I don't want to spend a lot of time on it, but I've started to look into them. And I have to tell you, it's one of the most frightening developments I've ever seen. I mean, basically, they're looking to pump up the value of and securitize almost all the land and natural resources. You know, they can take the national parks and securitize them by essentially using private contractors to be a service corporation and not sell the national parks, but basically market private control of them in a way that literally can move enormous amounts of land offline.
Yeah. And I think, you know, not to spend a lot of time, but you said the fact that there's 22 or 23 state attorneys fighting that is encouraging.
Right. So to me, the big issue, you know, our top stories, our top story of the year was 2023, the year of pushback. And I talked about how significant pushback was going to be in 2024. The issue, the war between sovereignty of the states versus the federal government is upon us. Mm-hmm. And it's really the question of can central bank printed money buy the states out of exercising and affirming their sovereignty?
Yeah.
You know,
and does the blackmail continue to work or do people resist it?
Right. Right. And if the state legislators and the state executive branch don't stand up, we're toast. I don't know if you saw this. The WEF put out an analysis of their survey of the top risks, both of the next 2 years and the next 10 years. And the number one risk in the next 2 years was misinformation and disinformation. And they attributed it to AI. But what you can tell reading between the lines is, you know, they're terrified of people communicating and telling the truth.
Yeah.
And I haven't paid attention to what's going on in Davos right now because they're all meeting. But the few headline I've seen is, you know, they're all talking about how to control the information.
Yeah. If I think about it from their perspective, I would think that would be an extraordinarily hard thing to achieve. Like for them to assume they can just control everybody and shut down dissent and shut down and do everything with it fails to recognize humanity and neighbors talking to each other, which sometimes people still do. And you still do see friends at the grocery store. And you know, it's I would think from their perspective, it's an extraordinarily hard task for them to clamp down on everybody.
Well, I think there are two things going on. One is they're trying to clamp down. But the other thing is, I think they've been living in their own bubble so long, they've forgotten what's true. And
you made the old saying that said, when people who lived in a rigged game get stupid or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. So I do think the Midianite thing is coming on us. And for anybody who doesn't know what I mean by the Midian, I think, go listen to my interview with Thomas Meyer on the story of Gideon. But it's a situation where Gideon's army is coming down the side of the mountain. The Midianites are sleeping in the Midianite army is sleeping in the valley. And they're so mean and distrustful of each other, they jump up and kill each other in the dark. So, okay, I wanted to mention the SEC has just approved the Bitcoin ETFs. So we've got 11 new Bitcoin ETFs. The price had run up. I think it had touched 49,000, and then it, it came down. So it was an example of buy the rumor, sell the announcement. Sell the news. And it's funny because when they pumped Bitcoin during when they were rolling out the vaccines, I kept trying to warn everybody, look, it's a pump and dump. And then, sure enough, I did this big interview with Mercola and a Bitcoin enthusiast, and it got dumped. And I got an email from Mercola said, well, I guess you're right about Bitcoin. And then he said, my understanding is it's dead. I said, no. Why would they give it up? They're going to pump it again.
Yeah.
Why would you give it up? It doesn't make sense. So,
but sure it's enough, kind of in the middle of the range right now. So it pumped up to like 60, whatever, 70, 65, and then it went down to 20, and now it's 40, and it's in between. And so now it's been pumped to some degree, and people are, well, do I buy? Do I sell? What do I do? And so you really need to, I think, know why you're holding it and have a strategy, because if you don't have any kind of a map to navigate, then you're just blowing in the breeze and you don't have any reference point.
It's a pump.
Yeah.
This is a pump. And my prediction, I'm going to watch what the ETFs are buying, but it's going to be a bank IOU price in Bitcoin, because there's no way they're going to be able to go out and get enough Bitcoin to properly, it's just going to be like GLD and SLV, like the precious metals.
Because the whole principle is that Bitcoin has a limit on how much can be created.
Right.
Which is why they equate it to gold or silver.
Not if you're BlackRock.
Well, yeah. But now you're going to, they used to do that in the years ago in the tech bubble collapse, shorting the S&P 500. You had to borrow SPY. And it used to be hard to borrow because there was so much demand to short it. There weren't enough of the managers creating the basket.
Right.
And that was with no limit to reality. Or there was a limit. There was a limit because you had to make the stocks part of the basket. But if you have a total IOU and it's not even connected really to the mathematical limit of Bitcoin, it's just, what is that?
It's just, so I don't know if you ever read the piece that Carolyn and I wrote about GLD and SLV. We called precious GLD and SLV. It was as Precious Metals Puzzle Palace. And basically, once you go through how they're structured and how it works, you realize, it's a bank IOU priced in gold and silver. That's what it is. Yeah. Okay, so I wanted to mention, because I think this is very important, that if you look at the Middle East, and The Economist came out with a piece called the New Middle East in the summer of 2023, The countries in the Middle East were really starting to move away from the U.S. channel, and they were building, equity that was competing with the U.S. So they're doing the golf tour, they're doing sports in the golf tour and really competing seriously with American businesses and, market share instead of buying treasuries. So they're kind of moving, they're showing a little bit more independence. And suddenly, magically, we have the U.S. go in with Israel to assert more dominance in the Middle East on October 7th. Yeah. So, I get back to the financial methadone. To me, this is a part of the issue of how is the U.S., whether in the petrodollar market, because now I think you had 20% of oil trade not in the U.S. dollar last year. So this is the U.S. trying to assert hegemony in both the petrodollar, but also in the oil markets, because we get Israel coming out right after the October 7th and announcing licenses and more aggressive development of all the Mediterranean oil and gas, which is oil and gas for Europe. So whether it's dominance of the oil and gas or of the petrodollar I think it's directly related to the U.S. ability to produce and inject that financial methadone.
Yeah, but then the behavior of the U.S. and Israel, then at some point, the more you erode your credibility, the harder that is. You can right. print money till the cows come home, but at the core of it, there's a move. Like you said, 20% of oil trading outside the dollar. That's right.
So at the end of the year, five countries go into BRICS, and they're all Middle East. So it's Egypt. You've got a bunch of countries in the Middle East. And if you look at the oil-producing nations, they're now clearly organizing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's funny. I don't know if you've been watching the lawyers at The Hague from South Africa accusing Israel of genocide. But you think about it, South Africa, of course, is the S in the BRICS. Mm-hmm. And those five countries come in, and you wonder if that was part of the deal, that if they came in, South Africa would take the case to the court, Hague, because they can't. They're afraid. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyway. Okay, so let's look ahead to 2024. Oh, I was going to mention, you know, I don't know, did you ever look at that article on the insider trading on the Israeli markets on October 2nd?
Yeah, I did. And it was a credible source. And now since then, they've had other articles that say they're challenging it and all this stuff. But to me, I find it pretty credible. And like you say, in all these things, you can look at the markets as an indication. And, you know, so I find that credible. And to me, what it equated right before the 2008 bubble burst, they removed what was called the uptick rule, where you used to have an uptick to short stocks. And they removed that right before the crash of 2008. So some of these signs are things to watch, I think.
Right. Well, what I took away from the October 2nd trading on the Tel Aviv market and then the ETF is, you know, don't tell me they didn't know. Because if they didn't know before October 1st, they certainly, I mean, there's no way that happens in Israel and the Mossad doesn't notice.
I agree with you. I don't think how do they not know? Yeah.
Right. Exactly. Okay. So let's look ahead. So, you know, every year we do these scenarios because I don't believe in prophecy. Mm-hmm. And it's one of my cranky issues with the internet, because we have so many people who are predicting very clear, you know, this is what's going to happen. The dollar's going to collapse. How many years have you been having to manage clients who were terrified through the internet that the dollar was collapsing the next day?
Yes, right. Absolutely.
Right. So our scenarios, you know, we do two axes with scenario design, and one is financial transaction. On one side, you have freedom. On the other side, you have complete control. And then you have the going direct reset or the building wealth reset. And that creates four scenarios. And of course, to me, the big one is, will we allow them to get financial transaction control? Mm-hmm. And I'm headed to the United States this Saturday, and I'm going to spend the next 5 months helping state legislators, you know, in Ground Zero's Tennessee, focused on creating the conditions of financial transaction freedom. Because I think our best bet is through the state legislature, you know, through state government. They have the power to protect it. And the political equation really is, can they, you know, does the population want the extra central bank money in the short term, or do they want freedom? It's freedom versus the methadone.
To me, it gets down to this whole issue that's been used to justify censorship on social media also, which is, we're a private company, so we can shut you down, whether it's censorship or your bank account. And without there's no due process because you're not. But I guess the question is, can you put a law in that allows due process and allows representation from the people who are being targeted? And you can look at somebody like Joseph Mercola. Like, how do you shut down his bank accounts without, it's under terms and service, right? Terms and the agreement.
Right.
So I would think you'd have to come up with some legal mechanism that says in this state, to shut somebody's bank account down, you have to have due process.
Right. And the trade-off is, if you want to be eligible to do business in the state, you have to conduct yourself according to certain standards.
Yeah.
So you can't tell them that they can't do it, but you can tell them they can't do it in this state. one of my chief concerns is for the states in their contracts and in their use of products and services. Are they agreeing to terms of services that move the jurisdiction outside of the state so that literally the state does not have jurisdiction over that telecommunication service, that IT service, that software package, et cetera, et cetera? Because if you agree to terms and conditions that say, okay, Delaware has jurisdiction, or, you know, with Microsoft, the state of Washington.
Every one of those things says that. This will be governed under the laws of Delaware. It'll be governed under the laws of North Dakota, whatever.
Right.
And to me, the only way to challenge that, you have to sue. But then the people, the small guy doesn't have the money to sue the giant corporation.
But the state does have the power to say, you know, on these functions, the state agencies, you know, and subdivisions cannot enter into contracts or agreements that trade away our jurisdiction. In other words, everything that taxpayers' money pay for in the state has to be subject to the jurisdiction of the state.
I think that's a good idea.
In fact, I'm working on bill legislative language for it right now.
So,
this is the issue. How, if you do a bullion depository, will it enhance sovereignty? Or if you just have all Microsoft systems handling it, you know, it makes it worse, right?
Yeah.
Right. So you got to get into the nuts and bolts of how you engineer sovereignty in terms of the governance structure, the, you know, the IT and telecommunications infrastructure and the precious metals infrastructure. Anyway,
that happens over and over again. If anything, from like the FBI taking over a case to bury it, or, you know, Microsoft taking over a thing and then they control it. So it could easily go that direction if you didn't plan for that.
Yeah, you really have to think it through, because it's one of the reasons, if you look at the Marvelous Seven trading so well, is they're sneaking in and overriding jurisdiction or getting sovereign immunity in a whole variety of ways. And it's one of the reasons I think their stocks are doing so well. So we have a variety of possible economic scenarios. And I just want to point out, if we lose transaction control, you don't need to worry about your assets because you won't have any.
Yeah.
You think I'm overreacting?
No, I think that's accurate. And I think that people need to recognize that the time to act is now. If you wait until you can confirm, like, oh, wow, they really did this now, like, I better start getting in the game, it's too late.
Right. Right. You know, it's funny. I looked at, if you look at the Rambus presentation, and I should point out to everybody, if you go to the website, we have the Rambus chartology and then the charts from last year under the financial market section. But if you look at the chart that he showed on long-term healthcare, he did one of the healthcare service ETFs. And you look at this chart that just goes like this. I mean, it just goes like this the whole way. And it's all rising on the great poisoning.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's your stock portfolio making money on the great poisoning. And you realize, oh, this is what happens when you get a win-lose relationship between how you've engineered the financial incentives and, you know, and life.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So
there are some cracks. I mean, I just anecdotally watching sports with my son saw our pediatrician advertising on TV.
Really?
And in the entire time we've worked with him, I've never seen that. So to me, that's a little crack in the dam there, because maybe they don't quite have as much business as they used to when they're actually going to advertise.
Wow. So it's funny because, you know, my favorite thing to do during the year is to find stocks, you know, for the screen. So I have a screen company, as you know, and we're constantly on the lookout for stocks. And you see, first of all, you see a whole world you never see through the news, which is hundreds of companies just going out and doing great things, and they get no attention, and, you know, they just make nuts and bolts, right?
Yeah.
And it's beautiful. They have, you find all these great companies, and they're not corrupt, and they're perfectly productive, and they're great companies. And in fact, some of them are so good, you think, wow. I mean, it's really impressive I find it unbelievably impressive what they accomplish. And yet, You know, you never hear that story. So that's very, very positive. At the same time, you see, I told you during the pandemic, after we had to re-underwrite all the stocks for what happened during the pandemic, we had to throw 80 off, including companies that I absolutely loved. Some of the greatest companies I thought in the world, I would have told you they would never have gotten thrown off the screen. Bam. And it's because the pandemic killed them. It really killed them.
Yeah.
And it was...
I was just surprised through that whole thing, the number of leaders of companies that just went along. You know, not even in healthcare companies. You're like, okay, whatever company I run, our company is going to fall in line with the vaccination or whatever.
Right.
And I just... I don't know. I'm surprised by the number of the people that at a high level that go along with that. And maybe it's control files. I don't know. But
I'm not surprised by it. So I became convinced it was not control files because the fact patterns didn't fit with control files. Control files, you know, when you get a CEO to do something, it gets much more messy.
Okay.
This was much too disciplined and orderly. And I think it's clear it was under military law.
Okay.
So Operation Warp Speed was a military operation. It was operating under military law. It overrode all sorts of civil laws. And I think the CEOs and the boards were under national security confidentiality laws and were under direct national security orders.
Yeah,
and they had no choice.
I mean, that would be something they wouldn't be able to say no to. If you're the CEO of a company and somebody says, well, this is national security, this is military law, you have to keep quiet about it, and this is the way it goes. I could see complying with it.
The only thing that, to me, that explains what I observed.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And including situations I saw very close up front.
Yeah.
And it was just, so I think you're talking about military orders and national security and national security confidence or confidentiality. Okay. So if we don't get transaction, you know, free, if we don't have transaction freedom, they're going to end up taking everything.
Mm.
So, you know, this is the year you have to do something. And I know you know this because you do financial planning. You know, people keep looking for how do I get around it? How do I get away? How do I? And there's no way. We either get this, we either ensure financial transaction freedom or they're going to steal everything. It's just a matter of time.
I mean, just quick, another quick anecdote. I went to buy sandwiches at a sub shop and I walked in and they said, all of our electronic menus, our internet is down. So we have no menus. We have no, you can't order. And then the guy said to me, well, if you have cash, but you probably don't. So, well, you know, they're going to make, so I said, I have cash. So they made the sandwiches. They gave it to me and he's like, I'm not charging you tax. So he didn't charge sales tax. And then I gave him a cash tip. So it was a small recognition for all those people working in the sub shop. They're like, we're totally down. We can't work. And he said, oh, wait, he has cash. We can make the sandwich.
Right. Reminds me of the governor of New Zealand, of the New Zealand Central Bank, who stood up after the cyclone and said, thank God we still had cash because otherwise we would have been dead.
Yeah.
Okay. Asset class outlook. Let's talk about asset class. Cash and bank deposits. So bank deposits are remarkably attractive now.
Yeah. You can get a good rate. And that the deposit, bank deposits, you know, you just make sure that the bank bank deposit, you're loaning money to the bank or even cash in the checking account, you're loaning money to the bank. Know the local bank. Know the people that you're working with.
Right. So, I don't know. To me, Carolyn and I did a 4-part financial rebellion in great detail about how to build a successful relationship with a great bank.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we go through it in glorious detail. And there's no reason why anybody shouldn't have a good bank.
Mm-hmm.
I think particularly if you're in America, you know, in Europe, it's much harder. Canada, it's much harder, but there's still plenty of selection in America.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I have to tell you, if you have confidence in your banks, feels great.
It does. And when you have a problem, it's night and day. Like if you go to Chase and you have a problem, it's hold on, I got to call this number, whatever. if the person knows you already, they don't assume right off the bat that you don't know what you're talking about.
Right.
there's at least a beginning of a working relationship there.
Right. Right. I don't, you know, if you don't have a great bank, go get a great bank.
Yes.
And yes, it's a lot of work, but it's worth it. It's worth it. Okay. Precious metals, you know, so precious metals clearly underperformed equities this year, but I don't know. I like precious metals this year. Now the miners have not done well at all. But I like precious metals this year. And, you know, I believe you should have a core position. And then if it's attractive to you as an investment, then you can do more. But I definitely like precious metals. And I do think if you look at how many states are starting bullion depositories and buying precious metals, I do think that puts a floor under the price. Now, clearly crypto and Bitcoin is pulling money, retail money, away from precious metals. But to me, that just makes it a buying opportunity. So,
yeah. And the long term, like the longer term look for, if you think we're going to have inflation, we're going to have a weaker dollar, is positive for commodities and for precious metals also.
Right.
But it's just like, how long do I have to wait for it to happen? You know, I'm holding in. So people lose patience, I think. But that's the whole point, is you have to be patient.
Well, I like having things for different scenarios. And I just, you know, if I have precious metals for certain kinds of scenarios and that scenarios aren't happening, you know.
Not getting worked up about it because you know that scenario is not happening right now.
Right. Yeah. Right. I remember what it was like coming into the, you know, the internet. I'll never forget the internet bubble because I was on the inside as they started to engineer it. And they were throwing money at companies that zero chance of ever making a profit. And it was frightening. And yet everybody drank the Kool-Aid and went up, and you just had to kind of turtle through and realize, okay, you know, and if you saw how much money people lost, you realize, okay.
Yeah.
Don't.
Even very wealthy people lost a lot of money.
Well, I'm hoping the plunder economy fails. Don't pray that the plunder economy succeeds. Really.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah.
Trust me.
Yeah.
Equities. Looks to me like equities are off to a good start. I don't see any reason why equities aren't going to have another good year. You know, my fear is it's going to be more plunder economy.
Yeah, I guess the risks are just, you know, it almost seems like there's so many negative projections for 2024 that anybody who's like a contrarian would just go the other way just because everyone in the world seems to be predicting collapse. And
right. So the reason I say dividends matter. You know, when I look at the I like to watch the Shiller PE numbers. And if you look at the PE numbers, you know, you are in the Western world, you're at very high levels. And, you know, I frankly would rather, if I was getting a spaceship and going away for a long time, I'd rather put money in the frontier markets or India, you know, because if you look at one of my favorite stock market sort of tracking websites shows you sort of what the long-term, you know, based on fundamental GDP, what the long-term outlook is for that economy and that equity market. I just don't see, other than a scenario where you have exploding breakthrough technology, including breakthrough energy technology, which could happen, I don't see how you do well buying in at these high PEs.
Yeah. Yeah, the ability of a company to pay a dividend tells you something about their financial management.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that's why I like dividends, because one way or another, at least you get the dividends.
Mm-hmm.
So
they do. I mean, you do see, though, when the market goes down, companies do cut dividends over time.
Right. That's true. Fixed income. Any thoughts on fixed income?
I try to just stay humble and stay prepared for the unexpected. And don't assume that because the Fed says they're going to be cutting rates, that rates couldn't go up. And just remember, like, the Fed is doing short-term rates.
Right.
If you have the 10-year Treasury is what governs mortgage rates, that's not controlled by the Fed. So you have to look at what term you do. But to me, the overarching thing is I suggest try not to lose money in bonds. That way to do that, two ways, is stay short. Or if you're going to have a longer term and get a coupon, do it in a way that you can hold that instrument to maturity.
Right.
And as long as then you realize it's a bond is a loan, I hold it to maturity. They didn't go bankrupt, so I get my money back.
Yeah. So lock in a good yield.
Yeah.
Though I would point out the junk bonds had a great year last year. Once again, I'm always wrong because I always say, you know, I would never do junk because I don't know, you know, when do you get out? And it just keeps doing well.
There's a couple of things about junk bonds. So junk bonds, first of all, the way they sell those is they call them high yield, because if they called them junk bonds, they couldn't sell them.
Right.
And second of all, there's a colleague of mine that used to manage bond funds in Boston who uses the saying, the yield is highest before it's not. Because right. as the company gets less and less creditworthy, they have to offer a higher rate to keep borrowing.
Right.
And so it gets higher and higher. It's highest before it's not, because at the end of the day, then they go bankrupt. So
one of the most frightening things to me in the economy and the market in the U.S. is how many companies in the stock market that are trading at remarkably high PEs are losing money and have been losing money for a while. So mm-hmm. when the Alaska Airlines incident, you know, happened, I went in and took a look at Boeing. They've lost money for the last 3 years.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, that and if you look at their market cap, it's phenomenal that a company losing that much money is still trading that.
Yeah.
At those high PEs. So it's okay. Real estate.
I think real estate can be a mixed bag, because you can look, it depends. I guess most individual investors aren't buying commercial real estate, but commercial real estate is getting killed. There's like
right.
empty office buildings. At the same time, in a lot of places, residential real estate it may not be blowing the lights out anymore because rates have come up to some degree,
right.
but it's not falling off, and it can be, you know, robust if you can earn rents
right.
that make sense on a cash flow basis.
It's very local.
Yeah.
You know, it's just real estate is local. We had a great interview with Michael Schumann last year on local investment, and traditionally I found many really astute investors who really know what they're doing in terms of both business and investment make their most money on local investment, but it's a very patient hunt and peck. You really have to know what you're doing. And most people don't have the time for it, but
I find the most successful in the local area a lot of times have the longest view.
Right.
And so they have a longer view than everybody. And so they're operating, they can be patient on something that other people can't be.
Right. They're very, very patient.
Yeah.
They're very, very patient. And they're very tough on the quality of people. They won't touch, you know, they will only do business with a very high quality. They won't touch
yeah.
anybody.
Yeah.
They're just very, mm-hmm. I would say they were a financial snob.
Yeah, but that can be a good thing in finances.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Yeah. So back to the great taking, one of the things that shocked me was that somebody who had been a real victim of the great poisoning, so they have vaccine damaged kids,
mm-hmm.
still thinks they're safe because of their stock portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, last issue is investing in yourself, in your health, personal resilience, getting your homestead resilient, you know, doing more locally to make sure you're protected. You know, you have a generator, you have your own energy source, all these different things. Tell us about personal health and resilience, because I know it's one thing you talk with your clients about.
I talk with my clients about, and I always try to make personal progress on that front. And to me, the only thing, I would say, include in that networking with neighbors, because you can come up with ideas. I think you're stronger together, and that has multiple benefits. It's not just sharing knowledge, but if something negative happens, you have people to turn to that can help you, and you can help them. So
right.
include in that the networking and having connections within your local area.
Right. And it takes time.
Yes.
It takes time. So part of that is now one of the things I've seen. So let me bring up a couple of issues. We've watched last year an unprecedented amount of precious metals IRA scams. And they all started out with things that put people in a state of fear, and then they make mistakes. So how do you help people? I mean, we did a great interview last year on how to find a good financial planner and, you know, or asset manager. But how do you tell people to get out of a state of fear?
I just recently read The Gift of Fear by Gavin DeBecker.
Didn't you love it?
I loved it. And to me, in a nutshell, people should read the book. But I'm just paraphrasing. But
did you read it because I recommended it to you, or you found out about it separately?
I did because you recommended it. But also then I realized when I watched the video of him saying that he provided security to RFK Jr. and how it wasn't. He couldn't a couple of things. He couldn't donate his services to RFK because it's not allowed under election law.
Uh-huh.
And then also the fact that RFK doesn't have Secret Service protection. So that kind of got me. I'm like, let me read that. But the most interesting thing I read about it,
I have to interrupt and tell you, I never do this, but I was so impressed by that video. I wrote to him and I said, Gavin, that is the single best fundraising video I have ever seen in my life.
Yes.
He's a remarkable person.
So a couple of things. First of all, you realize when you read the book that he had his own struggles as a young person, and that's what led him down the path that he went down.
Right.
But then to me, the biggest thing to me is that he explains that fear is innate. Your body knows when to generate fear, and it will generate it. But the rest of the time, if you're in fear, you're not in fear. You're worrying all the time.
Right.
But if you worry at such a high level, then you're always at a heightened state. So whether you're worrying or whether there's actual fear, you can't distinguish.
Right.
So to me, that just having that realization and realize that any self-defense program, no matter what basis it is, whether it's martial arts or firearms or anything, 99% of it is situational awareness.
Right.
And if you can just learn to pay attention to your surroundings without being worrying all the time and trust. And I think the takeaway of this book was trust your body to generate fear when you need it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, the other thing is train, you know, if you train for those scenarios, then you are much better able to handle them. A little bit of training goes a long way.
It does.
And yeah, that's a great, I don't know if you saw, we had Ulrich Onegger just did a Future Science series interview, The Indoctrinated Brain with Dr. Michael Neils. And he studied why people were acting against their own self-interest during the pandemic. And he's an Alzheimer's expert. And he got into, okay, how are they tricking people? How does it mechanically work?
I listened to that.
Oh, you did?
The very interesting thing is, it was something to the effect of, if you walk, I think he said 30 minutes, but I walk my dog every day. So I'm like, oh, I walk every day. Great. That it expands your hippocampus. And if you don't walk, it shrinks. So even things like that, like that he mentions a whole range of things, but I thought it was very interesting.
Well, all I will say, and I know you will agree, is if you're in a state of fear, do not make a financial or investment decision.
Absolutely.
Right.
It's like if you're put your investments in the freezer, in the ice box and freeze them up. So you have to have like a delay before you can access them again.
Right. Go out, hug a tree. Don't.
Yes. Anything. Yeah.
Okay. Big question. And it's one I tracked. Do you think the U.S. is going to tamper with the 401k and IRA rules?
I don't think when you say tamper, I think they're doing enough on the margin in the same direction, which is get more money out of 401ks and IRAs because it's increased tax revenue to the government. So things like the IRA rules under Secure Act 2.0 and things like that. To me, there's some of these things, if the government did something outside the law in a 401k, I think if they did that, they'd have to do it. It would be like the point of no return because it would be like the switch flipping. All these people that have comfort mentally, they would all wake up very quickly.
Right.
And now I guess the concern is that tampering would happen in a situation then where it's past the point of no return. But what do you mean by tampering?
You remember during the financial crisis when they tried to float a proposal that they would become annuities. So, or they would force them into buying treasuries. And the annuity idea, or they'd even privatize them and let them all be run by BlackRock, et cetera. But that was the government pensions. But essentially your 401k would become an annuity, where at the death, your heir wouldn't inherit it. It would be an annuity contract, and then the government.
I just think they have to have a lot of things in place. So, like, say they did that, and there's all different brokerage firms. People have IRAs all over the place. That the people, it's kind of like COVID, where they depend on the companies to enforce. They say you must do this with IRAs, and then the company would sit there and say, you know, Vanguard might say, okay, the rules are this now. You have to do this. And if it was so egregious, like, to get all the different CEOs, all the different operational people to all enforce on that, it's a little bit harder to think that it would automatically happen, that it would happen easily, not automatically. I'm not saying things couldn't happen, but to me, that would be somebody like hitting the trigger. That of all the people in the same thing with the great,
right.
Brings up the same thing with the great taking.
It's the great taking that the you're weaponizing something and it's working for you. Why would you mess with it?
Yeah.
Right. So here's the last one. And this is the one that most concerns me. And partly because I can't give anyone a formula to deal with it. And that is, we are watching in the insurance industry, private equity firms move in. And I've bought, whether it's an annuity or an insurance contract, and I've locked into the pricing based on the credit of the company. And then a private equity firm moves in and starts to do things that lower the credit quality of the company. You know, they're playing games out the back door. We did a big interview with Lucy Commissar last year. She had a big study where she looked at a couple of companies where this was happening. And so I'm paying a price based on the credit up front. But meantime, that credit is being sort of, you know, drained out the back door by the private equity play. And what I'm holding is not what I bought into.
And that's scary because once you have an annuity, you're locked in.
Right. Well, that's why I'm much, you know, if I wanted to do an annuity, I'd go to a bond dealer and I would put together a portfolio that would, you know, I would create an annuity.
You make a bond ladder of the of
right.
The
I would make a. Right. And that way I control. And if the credit quality starts to deteriorate, I can act because I have control.
I that to me is very concerning because I could see it happening. That
right.
Because it could it's like it's happening in the background. And then when it finally comes to a head, it could be
it's
very
too late. Right.
Yeah, it's too late.
OK, so another place we're seeing it, and I hear this from the doctors, is I pay for healthcare insurance, but when I go to the doctor, I'm liable if my insurance doesn't cover. And the doctors are telling me they're getting for things that they have pre-approved. So they don't do that test unless the insurance company approves it.
Yeah.
It gives them pre-approval, or they don't do that surgery unless they get pre-approval, but then they only get 25% reimbursement and they have to send the bill to the client. And it's because it's an insurance fraud. The insurance companies are basically saying you're insured when you're not. Yeah. And they're pre-approving things that are legitimate, you know, a legitimate test or a legitimate operation. And then they're just being late pay or not paying at all. And you get stuck with the bill.
Yeah, that's just more make work being put onto the doctors by the insurance companies. And if you ever look at any, and I have kids and I've seen these bills and it's like, okay, the doctor charges $200. The insurance company writes off and says, we're not paying $100 of it because we're the insurance company. Then there's $100 left. Then the insurance company pays $50 and then they send me the bill for the other $50.
Right.
And that means the doctor has to now have a billing system. They have to even more. They already had to do billing with Medicare, Medicaid, all that stuff. It's just another level of billing. More and more of them now have to offer online portals because otherwise people won't pay it. You know, it's like, oh, I got to wait to send the mail and I didn't mail it. And this and then for the people that they don't collect from, I guess you could kick them out of your practice, but you still didn't collect. You may even get to the point where, like in other industries, when they don't collect, they sell off all those unpaid things to debt collectors, and then they start the phone calling. You know,
right.
So it's just something that just doesn't mesh in any way to me with so-called health care.
Right. So what I'm saying is, when you look at an insurance product, you know, if you're doing a big contract with big fees on something where the credit can be changed over time without your knowing it, reconsider, do something simple that you control.
Yeah.
Much better. And then when you look at insurance, like a healthcare insurance, you know, don't be price sensitive, be quality sensitive. Because you want real healthcare insurance, you don't want healthcare fraud.
Mm-hmm. But your definition of that is a non-traditional one that people would have to be attuned to.
So I just think it's a matter of integrity. You cannot afford, you know, insurance is expensive, and it's, you know, where used properly, it's very, very important. You cannot afford to pay for something that you don't get, but you can't afford to get hung. Your house burns down. You can't afford to learn that your insurance company is not, you know, is not trustworthy.
Yeah. The way I approach that, I find it very hard to do the due diligence on a healthcare insurance company. The way I approach it personally is to just try to plan for it not delivering. And then ask yourself, if you plan for enough things aren't going to deliver, does it make sense for me to pay for this stuff anymore? But
well, you know, when I finished the litigation, I decided not to get health care insurance.
Yeah.
Because if you look at how much it was going to cost and what I could do by investing that money in preventative health care.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got a AAA policy that covered catastrophic for car accidents or travel accidents. And then eventually I went into Samaritan Healthcare, you know, which is Christians underwriting each other. And so that gave me a sort of minimum. And at the end of the day, it turned out to have been quite successful because I was able to spend a fortune on preventative healthcare.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, I would even argue, and I'm not, many people argue this, that health insurance isn't really insurance. It's just like a payment plan.
Right.
If more a traditional way of thinking about health insurance, it's just like a bigger cost. If something, you know, there's something I can pay for and there's something that I would struggle to pay for. And I only want to I only want to have coverage for those big things that would really hurt me if I had to pay for them.
So I'm going to grossly oversimplify. In my experience, healthcare insurance is something that covers payment for things that I would never use.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
So get with cash, you know, and figure out how you're going to do it with cash and figure out what's economic. And that's when you discover that, you know, all the upfront preventative care, you know, good nutrition. Don't tell me you can't afford good nutrition because it's cheaper in the long run.
Yeah.
So anyway, so Tim, you know, you're in the markets, you know, helping people or at least advising people and managing money, overseeing investments, and you're working with families. What keeps you up at night about 2024? What are the three things you most worry about?
I worry that some of these predictions are going to come true. So you have the stock market at a certain level, all these predictions about collapse, that something like that would happen. And then people, you know, ask me why I didn't tell them about it. Or they'd say, Tim, how come everyone in the world knew this was going to collapse and you didn't tell me about it?
Well, I mean, I think it's not just collapse, it's war.
Yeah.
Because I'm not worried about collapse. I'm worried about war.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I think I have some clients who have health impacts that it's not really, it keeps me up in the sense you worry about, like, what is the effect of this? And it's all the things, I think you mentioned the things, was it Toby?
Toby Rogers.
Toby Rogers.
Go ahead.
Basically, I think he explained that, you know, a situation where a woman had a $1 million 401k and a $1 million paid off house and then took health advice that really caused her problems. And then over time, they had to spend down the 401k and then they had to sell the house because they had to pay for all the health impacts they had from the healthcare, so-called.
Right. So I think people are being tricked by the great poisoning into letting healthcare destroy their finances. And that's where, you know, you've got to take charge and get the intelligence and say, I'm not going to let that happen to me. But it's a huge investment of time. And to me, the number one problem I have, because we have tremendous number of subscribers who've done that, you know, who've invested in learning how to take care of themselves into being a discerning user of healthcare services. Their problem is they are surrounded by friends and family who took the injection and now are sick or dying, and it's eating up their time.
Yeah.
And you can't say to your mother who's dying, you know, it was your mistake and you can't have my time.
Yeah.
Right. So that we're struggling in a population where the disability and death are rising significantly is what I see.
Yeah, I see that too in my own, even in some of my clients. And so it's just another set of, it's a different framework you have to think about it, I guess, and say, you know, here's where you're at now. Now we're going to do the best we can. And is that going to be good enough, you know? So
for the building wealth, I sat down with Ricardo. We do a building wealth with the annual wrap up. I sat down with Ricardo and I said, as 10 years as an investment advisor, where did my clients make the most money? And, you know, how did they really build wealth? And it was always by building a product, a service, a practice, or a business. It was from their own hard work and they built something that was successful. So they could be an author and their books were successful, or they could be a doctor and their practice was successful, or they started a company and the company was successful and eventually they sold it or they just kept it and made money. But in each case, they had to work very hard for many years to build something that added real value. Yeah. And they could only do that with a certain set of morals and faith.
Yeah.
And it took the ability to invest in yourself and invest in other people and work with other people. There's a lot of, but if you look at the moral skills and the spiritual skills and the people skills and the technical skills they needed, it was a certain combination. And I turn around and I look at a culture that is trying to destroy children from developing those things.
Yeah. And one of the most important things you mentioned in there is faith. Because many of these people, when you start, you're not sure if it's going to succeed or not.
And yeah, you have to have faith.
Yeah. Yeah.
So when I meet up and I talk with subscribers, the big question I have is, if you're going to build wealth in the future, how can you surround yourself? How can you teach your children to have that set of, to have that culture, and how can you surround with people who have that culture? Because without that, you know, that is required to build wealth.
Yeah, I try to think about with children to try to give them age-appropriate responsibility and let them learn directly, hey, I did this and this was the result.
Right.
And I saw a thing a long time ago that said, you know, that we're all children as we grow up asking questions, and the challenge is to remain a child as you become an adult and to not lose the ability to ask questions. Because to me, that's how you can grow and build and develop.
Well, you certainly do, because you're curious.
Yes, but I want to ever not lose that, you know?
Well, how do you, because you have maintained that. You're one of the most curious, you know, you're just, I'll never forget the first time I met you. Do you remember? You came to one of those things we had.
The event
across
in Malvern.
Yeah. And you were just like unbelievably curious. You had all these questions.
If I remember, I asked you about what would you recommend for an 18-year-old going to college? And you talked about things like coming up with your own map. Basically, and
right.
Figure, and you know, and what is college worth it or not? And we had that kind of discussion, but that it came from that question about what would you recommend to a young person kind of embarking on life?
Right. That's one of the most fun things I've ever done is working out with a young person, their learning plan and their curriculum, you know, for their college period. It's a fascinating thing to go through. And that's part of it.
I tell my kids, like, there's some situations in business where you think, like, if you ask a certain question, you're going to be looked at as stupid. But to me, the most experienced people are able, they've kind of gone through the looking glass and they're able to ask questions without being viewed as stupid. So like, don't get in that silo where you're like, oh no, I waited too long. If I ask this question, then they're going to think I'm stupid. Just get over that and keep asking questions. And then eventually nobody looks at you like you're crazy anymore when you ask questions all the time.
So I'll close with this. In the summer, during the summer, the years been business school, I was at Goldman Sachs. I was a summer intern at Goldman Sachs. So I created this rotating process for myself, and I ended up working in the mergers and acquisitions department in the bullpen. So it's your six associates, and I had one of the desks, and I was reading this incredibly intense document. It was my first merger agreement. And it was, you know, very hard to understand legally. So I raised my head and I said to all these brilliant people who'd been there for 2 and 3 years, you know, and were clearly impressive and, you know, from the best business schools, what's the difference between a merger and acquisition? And it began a conversation that went on for an hour and was stopped by a senior party walking in saying, look, you know, take this offline after hours. We need the work done.
Yeah.
And they didn't know. In an hour, they couldn't explain to me what the difference was.
Because they'd gone down the road. They came in as a new person, as an intern or as a junior associate. And then they just were going down the road. And they're like, well, if I ask this question now, a senior associate doesn't ask that question. So
anyway. Okay. Anything else you want to say before we close?
I think be encouraged in the year ahead. We're in Pennsylvania. I'm looking out at the snow on the ground. And I think just be encouraged and positive in the year ahead.
I came out of the annual wrap up News Trends and Stories very encouraged about 2024. I think we have our quote for the year was from Charles Swindoll. He said, I'm going to paraphrase it. He said, you know, we're presented with an unbelievable number of opportunities brilliantly disguised as hopeless situations. Anyway, but I think the pushback is on and it's going to be, you know, and clearly the top guys understand it because they are totally focused on censorship. And there's a reason why. Right. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And it won't work anyway. Okay, well, Tim, I'm going to be in Pennsylvania in March. I hope I see you. We're hoping to do an event in Pennsylvania. We're looking forward to that. So
I look forward to it. Absolutely.
Until then, thank you again for joining us on the Equity Overview. Ladies and gentlemen, check out the web presentation. The Rambus Chartology is particularly good. There's charts so you can see how the year is and a lot of great information, including in the News Trends and Stories section. So anyway, you have a great day. And again, Tim, thanks again, and I'll see you in March.
Thanks, Catherine.